Memoirs of a Christian Who Chose Abortion
by Joni Williams Shepherd.
Prologue. But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of Him who called you out of darkness into His wonderful light. 1 Peter 2:9. I stood on the tree branch, about 12 feet above the ground, holding the rope for the swing that was tied to a branch above me. It was recess, and I made the most of my time. Tommy stood on the ground below me, warning me to let go of the rope because he was going to swing on the swing. He won't really do that while I'm holding the rope. I was the quintessential tomboy, climbing a tree, a pole, a rope, or hanging upside down on the monkey bars as much of my free time as possible. The only girl in my small class, and miniature-sized, I had to stand my ground. Girls had to wear dresses at school, but thankfully, my mother supplied me with bloomers to wear underneath. It was 1968 at boarding school in Huehuetenango, Guatemala. My parents were Bible translators in a remote Mayan village, and Huehue Academy was where my two older sisters and I lived, except for long Christmas, Easter, and summer vacations. As I stood there, defiant, I was sure that Tommy wouldn't really do it. Though I couldn't process it fully in my 7-year-old mind, I was confident that I was exempt from falling. Tommy warned me a second and third time, telling me if I didn't let go, I would fall when he used the swing. But I was stubborn and kept holding the rope. In my mind, we were playing chicken, and I was no chicken. Even when he grabbed the swing, I was confident I was safe. The next thing I know, I wake up laying on Aunt Peggy's couch, crying with a severe headache. We called the teachers and house parents at the school and all missionary adults, aunt and uncle. I'd been unconscious for nearly 10 minutes after falling on my head. I'm sure my injury was worse than a concussion, but in those days, especially in a small city in Guatemala, I don't think they even x-rayed my head. I had a sore, soft spot on my head for many months and headaches for a couple of years. 2 years before that, at age 5, I hounded my parents to let me sleep on the top bunk. They told me no, because I wasn't big enough and I might fall. I begged until they finally let me. I promised them that I wouldn't fall. Living in a mobile home, we called them trailers back then, in Guatemala City, our second home there, it was impossible to hide the fact that I did fall, as everyone woke up with a loud thud on the floor. I think I pretended to not wake up because if I was awake, I would have to admit that my parents were right. Starting the following morning, I simply maintained my parents' amazing story that I didn't wake up in the fall. And if I didn't wake up, then I didn't remember. So no one could hold anything against me. It was just easier that way. They asked if I was hurt, and I said no, though I remember my shoulder hurting badly. 3 days after the fall, Aunt Helen, a nurse friend, noticed that I was holding my arm as I ran around and played. I must not have been climbing anything either, which was another clue something was wrong. Aunt Helen suggested to my parents that they take me to the doctor and have it x-rayed, as it appeared to her something might be broken. They had an x-ray machine in Guatemala City, and sure enough, I had a broken collarbone. They gave me a ridiculous wraparound cast that got me more attention than I wanted. By the time I was halfway through my 8th year of life, I had 2 serious falls because I was more confident of myself than I feared risk. I failed to heed the warnings, like I was somehow exempt from consequence. I wasn't afraid of heights, so what was the problem? Nobody's gonna call me Fraidy Cat. I'm going to go out and conquer the world and show you. I wasn't belligerent about it, just presumptuously self-confident. It was those who doubted my abilities who had the problem. Other than my pertinacious personality, I had a rather charmed childhood. Charmed not in the sense of wealth and conveniences, but charmed in the sense of parents who loved each other and their children and were healthy, functional role models in our home. It was also charmed in the sense that I never experienced any significant abuse perpetrated by a bitter or violent offender or sexual predator. I never knew trauma inflicted by another person's choice to purposefully harm me. I can't blame Tommy. He did warn me 3 times, after all. Boarding school was mostly a great experience for me, as I was quite adaptable and content, if there was some adventure involved. Plus, it was really neat to be big enough to go away to school with my 2 big sisters. Boarding school in Guatemala provided more than enough adventure. We got to play with stilts, which was exceptionally awesome for me as I was the shortest kid in the school through the 3rd grade. We got to roller skate, play ping pong, go on Saturday hikes, and play I'm the King of the Castle and You're the Dirty Rascal at the Mayan ruins. We got to experience earthquakes too. Certainly, the safest thing to do in an earthquake is get out and away from buildings. But the bigger boys had fun with that until the teachers came into view. They leaned their backs up against the outside wall to feel it shake. I wasn't the only one to seemingly not fear consequence. My life was good. I never even heard of divorce till my parents finished translating the New Testament and we moved to the States the summer I turned 9. I thought it was strange when I discovered my best friend Jackie only lived with her mom. As far as I knew, everyone's home was abuse-free and stable like mine. As I grew older, I learned that my home was the exception. This doesn't mean that I never had fights with my sisters or friends or argued with my parents. But at the end of the day, I knew I was safe and loved. My parents were strict, but not harsh. I experienced unconditional love and acceptance from them and most adults in my life. My parents never fought or even argued in front of us kids. Now, I know how bizarre that sounds to most people. I attended church from infancy. When I was 5 years old, my mother sat me down and explained that I was not a Christian just because she and my dad were Christians. You know what I mean. God doesn't have any grandchildren. I had to decide for myself if I would accept Jesus as Savior and Lord. So, at age 5, I gave up my life of sin and accepted Jesus in my heart. Okay, I didn't actually give up sin, but I began learning that when I sinned, Jesus paid the ultimate price, which meant I could experience forgiveness upon repentance. I was a pretty good kid, if not a calamitous tomboy. Even so, I had a mind of my own and was capable as anyone of disobeying my parents or other adults or God, as you will see. One Sunday, when I was 4 or 5, my parents gave me a nickel to put in the offering, and I rode to church with another family that morning. The mom asked me if my parents gave me money for the offering, and seeing a great opportunity for building my financial portfolio, I said no. She handed me a second nickel. I was astounded at my good fortune, but as quickly felt shame for my lie and ended up putting both nickels in the offering. My conscience was well intact, so I felt guilt about that lie for a long time, even though I did the right thing in the end. Over 50 years later, I'm finally confessing publicly. It's easier to love when you are loved. I grew up with love, so love is a more natural response for me than for those who grew up with abuse or neglect. And it's easy for me to love God as a father because my earthly father was so loving. I love God because he first loved me. So I talk about my life in relation to that love and what it means to live for him. Or what happened to me when I professed to love him but did my own thing. He loved me enough to not let me get away with harmful behavior. If this God talk feels foreign, I hope my faith journey intertwined in my story will introduce an amazing, relational, and loving God who forgives and redeems even people who have failed as badly as I. I remember loving music and singing from the beginning. I wrote my first song when I was 9, and the children's choir at our church, directed by our blind choir director, sang it in a service. In 3 verses and a chorus, the congregation heard that Jesus is the one you should know. What could a 9-year-old know about Jesus? I learned a lot in the previous 4 years since I decided to follow him. I wrote many songs throughout my preteen and teenage years, almost always about some aspect of God or living the Christian life. I was just 13 years old when I read the whole Bible through for the first time. My dad bribed me with a promise of a brand new guitar. If a bribe can ever be a good thing, this was a great example. I read it through, the Living Bible, in about 6 months, with great anticipation of the guitar. I read during much of my free time and when I was babysitting after I put the kids to bed. I couldn't fake that I read it. My dad made me tell him about each book and many individual chapters and asked me pertinent questions to make sure I didn't just skim through it. He was well educated in Greek and Hebrew as a Bible translator, so he knew good questions to ask. Though my initial motivation for reading the Bible through was the guitar, the more I read, the more I anticipated reading it. I underlined everything that stood out to me, and my understanding of God and his word grew daily. In the end, I appreciated what I learned as much as I appreciated picking out my new guitar when my dad fulfilled his promise to me. When I had a question about life or how things were done in the church, I searched through a concordance to help me find the answers in the Bible. Beginning in the 8th grade, I gathered my friends together for Bible studies. I started helping lead worship on Sunday nights. I shared my songs at church and Bible studies. I loved Jesus and everyone and knew God had awesome plans for my life. I didn't always do the right thing because I was a teenager. And sometimes teenagers do things they shouldn't, like sneak out at night during a slumber party and TP someone's house. Plus, I was human, and humans in general don't always make good choices. Even throughout high school, I still loved the Lord and had no plans to ever live my life without him at the center. I thought I was exempt from ever being guilty of serious sin because I knew right from wrong and how to get right with the Lord after I'd said or done something wrong. When I heard a testimony by someone who had overcome drug addiction, I felt a little sad that I would never have a cool testimony of Jesus saving me from anything exceptionally bad, as though somehow my upbringing was uncool or boring. I was taught very clearly and read for myself about not having sex outside marriage. Sometimes I would go farther than I knew I should with a boyfriend, but because I thought I was exempt from really falling, I was certain I was okay. I figured if we didn't have sex, I had not really sinned. The question in my mind was always, how far is too far? I think that is a common question among teens. Gradually, my standards for limits became increasingly gray. Even when I knew I'd crossed the imaginary line, I deluded myself that I was okay and I'd never do it again. I still felt that I was somehow exempt from serious sin or consequences. I didn't need a serpent to deceive and tempt me. I was perfectly capable all on my own. I still saw myself as a good Christian who would never engage in destructive behavior, and I'd certainly not allow myself to fall again. I didn't know much about things like drugs or immorality, other than I wasn't supposed to involve myself in these things. Since I had no childhood trauma from abuse, I had no need to self-medicate. My reason for not partaking in drugs in high school was not because I was a goody two-shoes, but because I didn't see the point. I never heard about abortion until my senior year of high school when, for some reason, one of my friends heard something about it and we looked it up in the dictionary. We talked about whether we would ever do that. I remember thinking if I ever got pregnant before I was married, which of course I never would, I would have an abortion. But I knew nothing about fetal development. I thought nothing of it. Plus, I planned on having a big family. More than a career beyond college, marriage and family were my ultimate goals. Even so, in my naive teenage mind, seeds of evil were planted, and a satanic foothold gained that would eventually play out. There was nothing in my education or experience to deter those seeds from taking root. I graduated from high school in Papua New Guinea at the end of a one-year trip around the world. My dad had gotten his PhD in psychology after finishing the translation work in Guatemala. He became a counselor for missionaries, and our trip allowed him to counsel and teach at mission bases in several countries. Before going to PNG, we were at a university in Australia for a couple weeks. I hung out with some of the students while my parents taught classes. One guy was friendly with me, but he didn't come on to me. I'll call him Kevin. We wrote to each other while I was in PNG. It all seemed innocent. My parents decided, since we were already down under, to spend a week in New Zealand for a vacation before heading back to the States. When I wrote to Kevin and told him about New Zealand, he went there also to see me. He wanted to take me out, and my parents let me go. Kevin took me to a party where they served punch. But it apparently wasn't just punch. When he brought me back, my dad could smell the alcohol on my breath from across the room. I don't remember feeling tipsy, though I had a lot of fun that night. When Kevin wanted to take me out again, my parents wisely said no. I begged them to allow me. I put on the biggest drama with real tears and finally convinced them to allow me to go shopping with this man. I would be fine. Didn't they know what a strong Christian I was? Near the end of our time together, we stopped by Kevin's apartment for something. I knew he didn't know the Lord, so I planned to give him my Bible and gave it to him when we arrived. I must have also given him my address in the States. It is blurry in my mind what happened after that, other than it ended in him raping me. I felt terrible about it and blamed myself for not listening to my parents. I certainly couldn't admit to them what just happened. I didn't even recognize it as rape at the time because of my own self-blame. It all happened so fast. I never saw nor responded to the man again, though he pursued me over four countries. I never told a soul about it until recently. It was so shocking and so beyond any category in my comprehension that I suppressed it deeply. Nearly 40 years later, I am finally beginning to discern the effect this may have had on me. It wasn't until I went through a sexual healing class last fall and then another one this fall that it dawned on me the profound impact of my gradual compromise in high school to the point that I didn't have any discernment about being with that man. I did what I did regardless of my knowledge of the Bible or my relationship with Christ. I never realized that the tiniest bit of fooling around would only lead to more and more. All of it served to cloud my thinking until I was so deceived that I could no longer see a clear boundary between right and wrong, good behavior and sin in the area of sex. Then, when I was taken advantage of so abruptly, I couldn't even call it what it was because of my calloused guilt before that day. I wanted to believe I was a good person on my own merit and that I was still somehow exempt from sin's consequences, mine or anyone else's. I wanted to believe I was still living that charmed life in which my childhood began. But my previous choices and what was taken from me that one horrific day left me reeling in ways I'm only now unpacking nearly 4 decades later. I was ashamed of myself, my lifelong belief that I was exempt from all this was already blown to smithereens before I turned 18, while I continued to convince myself I was okay. Strongholds from experiences and false beliefs were already set in place at the beginning of my adulthood that served to further cloud my thinking about relationships with men for decades and precipitated one foolish decision after another. My childhood dream of being a wife and mother was still firmly in place, but I didn't know how much damage was already done in my heart to tarnish that dream. The sin and consequences from which I thought I was exempt were about to determine a very different course for my life than I originally envisioned. I never, ever gave up on Jesus. He hadn't done anything wrong. I was the one who messed up. Me, the good Christian girl who led worship and Bible studies and sang meaningful songs. But I was no longer in my Eden. I was cast out of the charm and into a boatload of loathsome consequences. I floundered for many years and through 2 failed marriages, though I accomplished some good things during that time. I, the good Christian girl, I suppose that if I had done more things right, made pure choices from the first temptation, or at least repented immediately, I might still be the good Christian girl looking down my nose at all those bad sinners. I was proud, and I fell. And I fell hard. The consequences didn't go away as easily as a broken clavicle or bruised head. Just like Adam and Eve, I hid myself from God, or I thought I could, hoping he wouldn't notice and that perhaps I was exempt after all. Doesn't work that way. For someone who doesn't know the God of the Bible or has not experienced his love, the picture of what constitutes sin is probably murky at best. But I knew exactly what sin was, and I knew that sin separates a person from God just as betrayal separates friends. The only way there can be true restoration of the relationship is if the offending party humbly repents and the offended offers forgiveness. Whether the relationship is with a person or God himself, even with restoration, there are lingering consequences to betrayal. It takes only a moment to make a choice to cross the line into sin. But it can take decades or a lifetime to heal and work through the consequences once repentance occurs. I never heard any meaningful warning that the long-term consequences were not worth the immediate gratification of sexual sin. Equally perplexing is that I didn't know it was safe to come to my youth leaders or parents when I got in terrible trouble. I'm sure they never dreamed anyone would fall so far, so fast, They expected us to do things right, but weren't realistic enough about it to clue us in about what to do when we failed. They didn't discuss the kinds of consequences we might face. Praise be to God for His redemption in my story, though it was about to get much worse before it got better. Note, I include parts of the stories of a few of my friends, names changed, in these memoirs. They represent facets of a bigger picture beyond my own story. Regardless of our angles, we're all in this together.